Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey everyone, welcome in to the weekend edition of the KE Report. Corey and Chad here, your hosts for this weekend edition. Also your host throughout the week on our website, kereport.com, and podcast, The KE Report. For everyone listening on the radio, I recommend downloading the podcast or coming onto our website so you can get these full interviews, as sometimes the radio segments, they're a bit too time restrictive, and there's always a lot to talk about, even during these markets that, man, oh man, it's been a pretty boring week and a pretty boring month for markets moving mostly sideways. We are kicking off the show with Rick Bensignor, president of Bensignor Investment Strategies. Rick writes the institutional newsletter, Supposedly Irrelevant Factors, read by some of the most successful hedge funds in the world. And on the retail or more individual side, Rick writes in The No Trader, as well as 7-Eleven, where he picks no more than 7 of the 11 SPDR ETFs with the goal to beat the underlying S&P. Now, Rick, let's start off with these markets because, look, quite frankly, it seems like the markets are trendless. They're moving sideways. Even during earnings season here, earnings haven't really changed that direction. We can point to some of the bigger names that really control these markets is holding up okay. But again, these markets are boring. They're looking for a reason, it seems like, to move higher or lower. What's your broad assessment here of how these markets are, I guess, just moving sideways, consolidating in more or less the middle of its range?
Yeah, well, so Corey, recently, as you said, we've kind of gone nowhere. And even in 2023, we're kind of range bound. So in round numbers, you're talking 3850 on the bottom, 4150 on the top. We're certainly closer to the upper end of the range, but the S&P still has not been able to get above a key technical indicator at 4155 on Friday closes. And look, if it, you know, whether it's today or next week, or if it closes at 4160, I can't say, oh, it's broken out. But if you definitively break through 4155 to the upside, I think you're going to see some shorts get squeezed. There's, from a technical point of view, there's an unfilled gap from just north of 4200 to 4219. So that's one target. And then, of course, you've got 43.25, which was last August's high. You know, so those come into play, but I don't, and I've said this to you on your show for several months already, I don't concur with the rampant bulls on the street that were going to 4,500 and 4,800, test the all-time highs. I don't agree with the Mike Wilsons of the world that were going down to 3,000. We have played the range this year. We were bullish to start the year. We sold the first time we got up north of 4,100. And then we came back in when we didn't break down under 3850. And then we've lightened up over the last 2 weeks, all those long positions. So we've actually had a pretty decent year of just trading the range. But I think those who are playing for the bigger move, at least thus far this year, they have nothing to show for it other than a lot of verbiage that hasn't translated into anything. And that's for both bulls and bears. None of them, because what happens here is that the bulls get the most vocal north of 4,100 and the bears get the most vocal near 3,900. So when you think about, let's call them the Tom Lees of the world, the ones who are really bullish on the street, they're always being bullish in every commentary, but they seem to be the most bullish when we're close to breaking out, but we haven't done it yet. So they keep trapping. If anybody still listens to them, they're trapping people on the, you know, at the high of the year. And then if you go down to the Mike Wilsons and the really big bears, they're making their most noise when we're breaking down and close to the lows of the year. So if anything, they've trapped both bulls and bears, and we've been on the other side because we're just willing to play the range until something changes to take us out of the range. I'm a big believer in, and I did a video for my In the Know Trader. Every week I do an online educational video for anybody to watch on YouTube under my In the Know Trader banner. And I think it was 2 or 3 weeks ago, the focus of that week's video was do what keeps working until at some point it doesn't. And in this case, that means you sell rallies north of 4,100 and you buy declines down near 3,900. And in between, it's just all super short-term trading and you have no edge in the market. The only way to have the edge these days is to sell rallies and buy the dips, closer to the extremes of the year. And at some point that will change. But until it does, might as well do what keeps working.
Rick, I think that's such an interesting point to make, because when people grow up and they go to economics classes in high school and college, and when they go talk to their financial advisors later in life as an adult and they're trying to manage their money, most buy-side money managers are going to say, hey, just put your money in there and just leave it. And over long periods of time, that's true. Over long periods of time in the stock markets, they generally trend higher. But there's all these periods in between where you can have a trendless market for years, not just for months. And you're very effective in your publications at trading those ranges and using technical analysis and also using sentiment and psychology to your advantage. I guess just maybe spend one more minute on that idea, because so many people think they just got to plop money in all at one time and then to sit there for years. But if somebody's actively in the markets and following these markets every day, there's no reason to do that unless you're looking at trying to make money. And if you can make money in a sideways market. So maybe just unpack that idea a little bit more and how you do it.
Sure. Well, look, there's a couple things here at play. Financial advisor is going to tell you you need to be in for the long term, because it is statistically proven that the bulk of the gains in the market come on just a few days a year. And if you miss those days, you miss the gains. And most people don't realize that. But, if you miss like the five biggest up days in the stock market in the last couple of years, you are so badly trailing what the S&P has done. And most people don't have the wherewithal and the skills to be able to trade in and out with any frequency. So look, if you're a long-term investor, if you're a 25-year-old and you're putting money in an IRA account or a 401k account at the firm you work for, yeah, just put it in the market. You've got a 40 to 50 to 60-year time horizon. Just put it in and don't worry about it. And every once in a while, take a look if you need to reallocate into different areas, but that's long-term investing. If you're 60 years old, you can't look at it the same way because you don't have the same time frame. And that doesn't mean that you get down into day trading or trading three times a week and flipping your portfolio constantly, but you don't have the same time frame. So you have to be a little more on top of what's going on and understand more about the idea of long-term investing for you is now kind of medium-term investing. So you have to shift to the time frame that you're looking to potentially hold. You also have to think in terms of a financial advisor has a incentive to tell you to be in the market all the time and don't try to play it, because they're paid based on assets under management. And if you sell out of stocks and put that money into cash until you reuse that money at a later time, they don't get to make money on what's sitting in cash in your account. They only get to make money on what's invested. So, there is a natural conflict there that, of course, they're not going to tell you about, but they have an incentive to keep you invested all the time. And that's why when markets come off and people call their financial advisors, the financial advisors will say, don't worry, hang in there, it'll come back. Historically, that's true. But you have to decide whether or not you want to, maybe you call them when the S&P only fell 20%, but it's going to be falling 50%, and you'd be much better selling out of a good chunk and then putting it back in at a later time. It all depends upon how close you are and to the market and what your skill is in order to be able to play the market. Most people can't effectively sell out and then replace those sales with purchases at lower levels. I certainly understand Wall Street's selling message to the public, which is stay in the market for the long term, but do understand it's a self-serving message that they're telling you.
Fair enough. Now, Rick, you use behavioral finance in some of your analysis. We touch on that quite regularly. How does your behavioral finance play into this debate that's ongoing? That in all fairness, no one knows what's going to happen, but there's a lot of talk about a recession coming, a bigger market pullback, even a market crash. But then there's also the other bulls out there saying, oh, you know what? The worst is behind us. Just wait for the Fed to stop raising rates, and that's going to give another boost to the market. How does behavioral finance play into these big picture themes that nobody can predict?
Well, of course, nobody can predict. But when you do predict, think about it in terms of it's virtually or close to a 50-50 chance that you're going to be right. It's not quite 50-50 because the market could just go sideways. So as we've seen for this year, neither the bulls nor the bears are actually correct. But if you think about it, you know that over the long term, you want to own equities. Look at a 20-year chart, a 50-year chart, a 100-year chart of the U.S. stock market. And you're going to see it basically start in the lower left-hand corner of your screen and end in the upper right-hand corner. Long-term, you're going to make money in equities because the growth of America persists over time. And despite the occasional recession that pulls stocks down, historically, returns are positive and you're going to make money. So there is a natural bias to be long stocks. And it made sense because that's how you make money. It's not sitting in cash. It's being invested in stocks and other assets too. But certainly the stock market is one of the single best long-term investments you can make as an individual. So even if you don't know what you're doing, you can either have an advisor do it for you. You can have a robo-advisor do it for you for a much smaller cost. Or you can just buy some spiders and QQQ in your account, which is the S&P 500 and the NASDAQ 100. ETFs, and you'll just do fine over time. The behavioral finance comes in when you have periods of time where the market is not a straight up instrument, and there are ups and downs and ways of taking advantage of the reality that most people who alter their portfolios tend to do it at the wrong time. The public generally withstands a sell-off, but the more it sells off, the more they're hearing, oh, we're going down, and then you get the bears crawling out of the woodwork, and they end up scaring people out of long-term holdings generally darn close to the bottom, because that's when the noise is loudest. It's the same thing flipping on the upside, where sometimes you have a rip-roaring market. Bitcoin, for instance, would be a perfect example of something that just kept moving higher and higher, and a lot of people don't want to partake. And eventually, by the time you partake, you ended up paying $40,000, $50,000, $60,000 for a Bitcoin, only to see it fall, you know, in the last 6-8 months down to $16,000 before now bouncing up. So the public generally times this stuff wrong. And when I identify the biases that exist both in the average person who plays markets, but also professionals who are maybe a professional, but many of them, because they are human beings, make the wrong mistakes at the wrong time. I can take advantage of that understanding and being able. I'm one of the few, in fact, I don't know anyone else, and I'm not saying there aren't anyone, but I'm now on the street over 40 years. And I don't know a single other person who has effectively been able to take the concepts of behavioral finance theory and literally apply them to trading the market. Given the relationships I have on the street and the people I know, I have yet to find somebody else besides myself who's actually figured out how to take and kind of decipher the biases that exist in the financial decision-making process and apply it to understanding when to buy and sell, whether it's stock indexes, individual names, the bond market, etc. I mean, we sold the yield chart. So think of it, we bought bonds this year at 4.28%. The high for the whole move was 4.33%. We played for a large down move, which we got, and then we resold 3.86% and covered it 3.5 and 3.4. And then recently, just 2 weeks ago, you guys get my reports. I turned bullish the yields, that's bearish bonds, at 3.3. And the low of the move was 3.25. And now we went to 3.6, and now we're back at what, about 3.55. I mean, we have played this. We've done the same with the dollar. We sold, we got all our longs at 112.5. The high of the move, I think, was 113 or 114. And then we put them back on at 100.5, which was the low of the year, and kicked them out at 103, 104, and 105. So we've been able to play these moves and kind of gone counter trend. We've essentially sold highs and bought lows across the asset classes simply by being able to figure out where the bulk of people and the story is the loudest at the wrong time, and it sucked the most people in.
Well, Rick, let's dive into this idea a little bit more, but let's also talk about sector rotation and what you do in your 7-11 report, where you pick 7 ETFs or no more than 7 versus the 11 ETFs in the spider funds to try to outperform the markets. And that's kind of where I was getting in the previous question was, yes, there's people that hold for the long term and over long periods of time, decades, you know, younger investors will be fine to buy and hold. But then that means they don't really need to follow the markets that closely and listen to interviews like this, because they're just going to camp out and just keep dollar cost averaging. But for people that are active and they want to do sector rotation, you're not just using behavioral finance, you're using technical analysis to use some of those price levels. And just how do you do it? How do you pick the sectors that are going to outperform?
So I use a combination of macro fundamentals, what I believe is the most superior quantitative model on the street for sectors, technical analysis, market timing, and elements of behavioral finance to pick which 7 of the 11 macro sectors to be in. And this year, I can tell you through March 31st, we are exactly flat on the year versus the S&P. And I actually consider that a minor victory in the sense that January was incredibly difficult on almost any money manager because the sector rotation was massive compared to what we had seen in 2022. Everything in January unwound what had worked in 2022. And everything that didn't work in 2022 was now the leaders in 2023. So in March, we actually had our best month ever. We outperformed the S&P that month by 1.81%. But that got us even because we had a lousy January. But the most important thing is to look at how we did over time. So in 2022, we outperformed the S&P by 6.01%. Historically, since we started this report in August of 2020, we have now outperformed the S&P by 12.77%. So think of this. If you had $1 million invested in spiders, you'd have an extra $127,700 if you listen to us on how to be in the S&P sectors as compared to simply owning the spiders. That's huge. In the money management industry, we're averaging beating the S&P by 40 basis points a month. I dare you to find somebody who consistently does that. It's very hard. And we've been fortunate because we anticipated we were bullish in 21. We were bearish in 22. From the third week in January, I turned bearish. And so we allocated much more defensively throughout 2022. Fortunately, in December of 2022, I pulled financials, XLF, out of the portfolio, and I put XLC in its place, which is communication services. So we were able to get the big rally from Meta and Google that we've seen since their bottoms. And this is, you know, this is the game that most portfolio managers play. They may do it down to the individual stock level, but ultimately, if you're benchmarked to the S&P, you're trying to figure out which sectors to be in and which ones to be lighter in. What I've done in the 7-Eleven report is subscribers get a report once a month that reallocates 7 of these 11 spider sector ETFs like XLK, XLP. They all start with XL, the State Street spider ETFs that are the sector ones. And what we do differently compared to most who play the game is that they're in all 11 sectors and they just change their percentages. What I did is said, you know what? I can beat the S&P. I don't need all 11 sectors. I can do it with 7, take less risk than being in 100% across all the sectors all the time. So we're in 7 sectors, but we're 100% invested 100% of the time, which is not in all 11 sectors. So I have to overweight sectors that I'm in to make up for the allocations or the percent of the benchmarks that we're missing. So let's say if we don't have utilities in, well, that's 3% of the S&P. So I've got to reallocate an extra 3% somewhere amongst the seven that I do have. And so if I'm missing four sectors, I've got to accumulate how much of the percentage those four sectors equal that I don't have in our portfolio and reallocate them to the sectors that I do want to be in. So for instance, we've been long energy since the summer of 2021. I think it was August 2021, we went into energy. And currently it's about 4.5% of the S&P. It's been as much as about 5, maybe 0.3% of the S&P. But on our peak, we had 10% in energy because we actually got in beautifully. It never traded against us in relative terms to the S&P. So once we got in August of 2021, the energy sector has outperformed over time. And we've had it as a large weight. Right now, we have it down at, we're 7% versus 4.5%. So we're not quite double it, but we're well off the highs because we had taken out so much in it. I lightened exposure, but I still wanted to be in energy. And this is kind of the game that you play. And to outperform the S&P by 12.77% over 32 months, it averages almost 4% a year. And that is very significant because you realize most portfolio managers never get to beat the S&P. They might for a year, but over time they don't. And our process has shown that over time we can beat the market and play this game. So instead of being in spiders, 100% in spiders, if you put money, as I tell you, to allocate across these, you know, seven, and we change them each month. And that doesn't mean every month I'm pulling out, you know, doing a wholesale change, but we often change how much you have. You might be, for instance, XLK technology is, I don't know, probably about 24% of the S&P right now. It just got lowered recently because the S&P changed some of the names and moved them around. So they're no longer in tech, but you know, I've had as much as 37% in tech and as low as about 26% in tech. So each month I may fine tune and tell you from be 28% instead of 26%, but something like tech I've been in, even when it went down, I just had a much, much lower allocation to it because it's so big as a percentage of the S&P. If I took XLK out of the portfolio, I'd have to come up with 25% or so to reallocate elsewhere. And that would really make other ones very big bets relative to their benchmarks. So it's really understanding what the game is, and this is all about relative outperformance. The goal is to outperform in an up year. The goal is to outperform in a down year. But the goal is not, this is not a hedge fund. This is not like, hey, no matter what, we're going to make money. Last year, the S&P was down 18%. We were down, or 19% rather, and we were down 13%. Yeah, you still lost 13% of your money, but you didn't lose 19% of your money. So if you're going to be in spiders for the long haul, and have exposure to the S&P 500, I can tell you based on history so far, you'll do much better in allocating based upon the 7-Eleven report than you do just parking your money in spiders.
Hey, Rick, I've followed along with you for a while here, and it has been impressive how you have managed to consistently beat the broad averages, the S&P. Let's get into a couple other sectors. You've given us some insights on how you're playing the bond market, even how you recently played the dollar. What about gold? I know you were riding that wave higher for gold and even some of the gold stocks. And for the most part, they were going sideways this week, a little bit of a drop at the end of the week. What's your outlook for that sector?
So since the false breakdown, which was, I think, early fall last year, September, October or so, when gold broke beneath 1675, which had been seven prior lows in gold, $5 either way of 1675. So when it broke last year, it should have really cracked gold, and it didn't. And we spent, I don't know, a month or two, probably 2 months, under 1675, but even above 1600. And in my view, if gold was going to crack, it should have fallen a few $100s. And the fact that it didn't, and then we had that very large up move in probably early November, that took us back above 1675 and even 1700, that was your clue that gold had a false breakdown, that it wasn't going to crack, and that the selling that came in on the break of 1675, as well as longs getting stopped out, was not the right way to play. And history tells me, from somebody who's observed the commodity markets for 40 years, remember, I started as a pit trader right out of college. My first job was trading on the floor of the exchange, the commodities exchange. And I grew up in this industry. I know it well. And when you see a false move like that, you almost always go back to the complete opposite side of the range. And in this case, you're talking near all-time highs. So we had come from north of 2000, what was it, a year and a half ago, something like that. Actually, it was March of 2022. We were north of 2000. Then we sold down in the fall. We had the false breakdown. And then so we've come all the way back to 2000. So we've done that. And we're in striking distance of all-time highs. But for the last 2 weeks, our upside target for this move was 2024. And we got past it a couple of the last 2 weeks, not including this week. But come the Friday close, we always close beneath 2024. So we actually have taken off now 50% of our longs in gold. And I think over time, gold will make new all-time highs. But if I can buy gold back, you know, if I sell out a half up here against resistance and we can buy gold back $100 or $150 lower, it certainly is, I'll be ahead than simply just holding on. So I like gold over time. I still do think that the fundamentals would suggest gold moves higher over time and will make new all-time highs with targets in the, I'm trying to remember, 2460, I think, and then 2800 something are my two upside targets. I forget what they are, but it wouldn't surprise me if gold pulls back and even gets, you know, pulls back under 1900. Right now it's 1991. So I like it, but you're at the top end of the range. And I've been telling clients for weeks now, you do forget what you hear on TV. You don't want to be first be buying gold now. The easy money's all been made.
Some good thoughts there, Rick, on the precious metals. And we'll keep looking at some of those price targets. I'm sure people would be excited if we got to some of those upper end price targets over time. But let's also talk, since you have the commodities experience in your blood the last 40 years, let's talk about black gold. Let's talk about oil. It's been on a wild ride. I know you weighed it, like you say, a little heavier in your 7-Eleven report. And oil was down selling off in the mid-60s just last month. And had a reversal of fortune, was up in the mid-80s. Now it's in the mid-70s. Seems to be kind of whipsawing back and forth. What's your take on oil?
I actually think it's probably okay. The OPEC news gave it a real jolt, you know, higher a couple of weeks ago. We've given back this week, essentially gave back all of that rally, but we're still above support. That $66 target was a target I had on the downside since November of last year, and we got it, and then the U.S. was supposed to, or there was certainly talk that Biden's was going to replenish the Strategic Petroleum Reserve under $70 a barrel. And they had the opportunity, but they actually didn't do it for some technical reasons. And I don't mean technical as far as charts. There were reasons that they couldn't actually buy it at the time. And the markets moved higher and, you know, got to the low 80s. Now we're at about $78. And I do think that if I had, I can't tell you the next $5, but if I had to guess the next 20, it's to the upside.
All right, Rick, we'll wrap it up here. Always great hearing from you. We do have to run to our next call, and we are out of time for this segment on the radio, but very interesting how you're looking at these markets and really what a sideways market, the opportunities that are available. I understand we're all waiting for either a big breakdown or a big breakout, but hey, we might be going sideways for a while here. Rick, thank you as always for your time. Everyone, I'll post a link to Rick's website where you can find out all of his products for investors, and I highly recommend following along with at least one or two of them. Thanks for your time this weekend, Rick. Have a great rest of your weekend.
You guys too. Thanks for having me.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout.